The UK Investor Magazine podcast is brought to you in association with Oanda, the broker of choice for traders who want a smarter way to trade. Trade with Oanda and get 1 year's subscription to TradingView Pro. 76.6% of retail investor accounts lose money when trading CFDs with this provider. You should consider whether you understand how CFDs work and whether you can afford to take the high risk of losing your money.
Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. The latest on shares, markets and investments. Now available on your Amazon Alexa.
For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into the world of private equity and one particular trust, investment trust from Aberdeen, the Aberdeen Private Equity Opportunities Trust. And to do that, we're very kindly joined by Alan Gould, who is the lead portfolio manager on the trust. Alan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
So we're actually holding this podcast a few weeks after Alan presented one of the UK Investor Magazine virtual conferences. There were some great questions that came in then. So we're following up with our podcast. We're going to be providing an overview of the trust as well as the wider market. So before we get into it, Alan, please, would you be able to give us an introduction to yourself and the trust, please?
Yeah, of course, Jonathan. So I'm kind of in my 14th year of working in the private equity industry, and I've focused on making investments into private equity funds and direct co-investments throughout that time. Now, I started getting involved with the trust in 2017 following the merger of Aberdeen Asset Management and Standard Life. And then in 2019, in the tail end of 2019, I was asked to take on the lead portfolio manager role of that trust. So certainly the timing was quite interesting, given a few months later I was, you know, we were in the middle of a global pandemic, and then obviously this year with the war in Ukraine and inflation and interest rates. So it's been an interesting time, and certainly I'm kind of hoping for some calmer waters at some point. But on the trust itself, Aberdeen Private Equity Opportunities Trust, or APO for short, was launched over two decades ago, way back in 2001, and it used to be called Standard Life Private Equity. And really, like, you know, all private equity trusts, has the aim of providing access to the private equity asset class to investors of all types and sizes. Private equity has really been dominated by large institutional investors, and so it's about democratizing that and giving access to the asset class for the price of a share, which at the moment is about £4.50. So, but in terms of what differentiates the trust, I suppose, is, you know, firstly, we're very focused on the European market. Most private equity trusts, certainly the diversified ones, are majority focused on North America. And that makes sense. It's the largest market. It's the birthplace of private equity. But our trust is at least 75% European private equity managers, at least 75% European headquartered businesses. And we think Europe is attractive in a private equity context because it's heterogeneous. It's difficult for a North American private equity firm or an Asian private equity firm to fly in and out and make deals. You know, there's different languages, cultures, regulation, legislation. I mean, it's just not feasible that a manager can fly in and go into Paris and secure a deal in the French market, you know, quite a closed market like that. So it becomes more about accessing the best managers on the ground who are often in demand and oversubscribed. So that's what we provide, is that access to the leading European managers, or some of the leading European managers. But another point, a differentiator on the trust, would probably be the fact that we're focused on the buyout segment of the private equity market, and the majority of which being mid-market buyout. We don't have any venture capital exposure, which is a part of private equity that's done very, very well over the last 10 years. But, you know, in the last year or so, obviously, is a part of the, you know, probably the main area that has suffered in terms of valuations. So we don't have any VC exposure, very little growth equity exposure. We stick to the boring, profitable, cash generative businesses that are majority owned by private equity firms. So that's another thing that makes our trust a little different. You know, we have over 650 underlying companies, well balanced by sector, country, and maturity. And we get our exposure through private equity funds and direct co-investments. And you know, the latter is quite an important point because, you know, at the start of 2019, we had no co-invest exposure in the trust. And co-investments basically strip out a layer of fees. You don't pay fees on co-investments. And that means if you build a nice, big, diversified portfolio, it should be accretive to returns. So we had no exposure at the start of 2019. But it made no sense why we had no exposure because we had a co-investment team investing on behalf of other client mandates. Fast forward to now, we have 25 co-investments in the portfolio. The co-investment portfolio grew 58% in the last financial year in terms of valuation, and now equates to around 20% of the portfolio. So we're really excited about that and the potential it will have in terms of driving NAV performance. Just to round off, the trust also pays a quarterly dividend, which equates to around a 3% yield. And lastly, in terms of performance, the annualized NAV total return since inception is over 11.5%. And in the last financial year 22, the NAV total return was 14.1%. And the NAV has grown every year since 2010 in the trust.
Thank you. So there's an interesting point there that you made that I'd like to pick up on, Alan, about the bringing in the co-investments into the trust and the impact on NAV. I mean, how have you seen that perform? I mean, typically, are you seeing greater increases to NAV due to co-investments, or is it in line with the more traditional investments in funds that you've made?
Yeah, I think we're still seeing a little bit extra growth in the co-investment portfolio. Some of that is through, without patting ourselves on the back too much, like some really strong early picks that we made. I mean, Action, which is well known through 3i, continues to grow extremely strongly. We've got a contract research organization in the healthcare space called NAMSA, which is performing ahead of plan. Visma alongside HG is performing very strongly. So there's an element of performance there, but there's also a technical thing with the co-investment book is that a lot of managers value their assets at original cost for the first year of their life. And as our co-investment book is still quite immature, shall we say, sort of the average age is still a little less than 2 years in terms of holding period, we're starting to see a lot of these assets being revalued for the first time. And that strong earnings growth during the period is starting to be reflected in the valuation for the first time. So that's certainly a technical reason why we're seeing a good, strong momentum from that book and why we saw growth last year of 58% in terms of valuation.
Thank you. That's great. So I think what I'd like to do now, Alan, if it's okay with you, is maybe take a bit of a step back and take a look at the bigger picture of why people should look at private equity. We've, of course, discussed there how the trust is being managed, some of the strategies that you're putting in place. But it would be good to get your view on why private equity should be considered within portfolios.
Yeah, well, we fundamentally believe that all investors should have some exposure to private equity. Now, you could argue whether it's 5% or 30%. I think that's really dependent on the risk profile of the portfolio people are looking to build. But, fundamentally, private equity combines strong returns with some diversification benefits relative to public equity. So I think on returns, it's pretty well understood now that private equity outperforms public equity. Obviously, some research pieces that try to prove the other way. But what's without doubt, in my eyes, is that top and second quartile performing private equity comfortably outperforms public equity. And that's what we aim to provide in the trust, is access to those consistent performers in the top or second quartile. And in terms of the diversification, it's also not as correlated as one might think with public equities. There is correlation there, but our research suggests that the correlation since 2000 between European private equity and the MSCI Europe is 0.57. So there are some diversification benefits as well. So then it sort of leads on to what are the broader trends supporting the asset class? And, you know, you've likely heard these many times, but I'll reiterate that the companies are staying private for longer. You know, looking at recent data by Edison, there was around 10,000 PE-backed companies and almost 6,500 growth and venture companies. So that's, you know, 16, 17,000 companies. And back in 2000, this combined figure was less than 3,000. And then contrast that with the number of US listed companies. In 2000, there were around 7,000, and now there's less than 5,000. And that trend actually goes further back to the 1990s as well. And there is an element of, at the top end of the stock markets, the concentration and the sort of the fangs or whatever they're called now as well. So so that's certainly a key factor. And access to capital continues to increase for private backed companies. PE is, I think, around 5 trillion AUM at the moment in dollars, and is expected to double during the next decade. And that has a knock-on impact when you're looking at, say, IPOs, for example. And classic example is, you know, Amazon back in 1997, it IPO'd at less than 500 million. But then you compare that to Uber's IPO in 2019 or Airbnb in 2020, which were, you know, well, over 75 billion in Uber's case and around, you know, 45, you know, to 50 million, billion in Airbnb's case. You know, it's a real massive step change. So yeah, I think that the, you know, in addition to that, I think the governance model of private equity is also a little bit underappreciated by the market. The fact that private equity owners sit on the board, often have majority control, can, you know, in extreme cases hire fire management, but can also support management much more effectively now as well, and be a partner, I think is very compelling when you compare to public equity, when, you know, the shareholder base is highly dispersed and you know, a lot of influence is really through proxy voting. I think the governance model is certainly a powerful part of the asset class, and that is just being underlined or being further helped by the fact that private equity firms, following the global financial crisis, they've really gone down the route of becoming much more specialized by sector. And some of the specialists have almost like trade buyer levels of knowledge in certain areas, whether that's certain areas of healthcare or certain areas of software. You know, they're able to add so much more value to their companies and be a much better partner to their companies than they used to. It's sort of days of passive investment and financial engineering, you know, you're kind of over. If that's what you're relying on as a private equity firm these days, you're just not going to survive. So yeah, it's more specialist, the strong governance model, and the fact that companies are staying private for longer, I think, are compelling reasons why, if you want access to companies of the future, the disruptors, the innovators, and the niche market leaders, private equity is the place to find them generally.
So with that trend, Alan, you put companies staying private for longer, is that ultimately a good thing for your mandates?
Yeah, I think it is, because it increases the pool that you can access, really. And I think it's good for the companies as well. I mean, sort of the availability of capital and having partners that can really help you and support you, whether that's, you know, you're looking to launch new products or move into a new geographic market or to buy a competitor business and really take a step change in terms of scale. And to have a partner like a private equity firm that's done it over and over again, I think is quite a compelling sell to founders and management out there. And then from our point of view, it just increases the pool for our private equity managers to source interesting deals as well. So yeah, I think it's a positive thing for the asset class.
So with this trust, there's obviously a disconnect, Alan, between the assets that you invest in, of course, privately held, you know, are not that often revalued on a NAV basis. But then being an investment trust, you're out there in the market and you're facing the gyrations of the equity trade out there. And of course, you know, looking at the discounts now for private equity trusts, they have got a little bit bigger over the recent period. Do you think that's justified, or do you think that's a symptom of wider concerns about the economy and markets?
There's no doubt wider concerns are at play, but it won't surprise you that I think that the discounts are unjustified in terms of how wide they are right now. We've only really seen levels like this for PE trusts across the board at the start of the global pandemic in March 2020 in the global financial crisis, really. I mean, almost all PE trusts are trading at a discount, and most are trading at a discount above 30%. And I think that's driven by sort of the skepticism that we're hearing from some quarters, you know, around the fact that we've seen public markets fall considerably in 2022. And people expecting private equity to mirror or even exceed these declines. And, you know, but in last year, for example, in the financial year 22, APO's portfolio grew in constant currency terms by 11%. And most private equity portfolios were at least flat year on year. So it's sort of people have been scratching their heads a little bit in that, and combined with this sort of lag in reporting, they're expecting somehow PE portfolios to start falling. But I think it's a lack of understanding on how PE valuations work in practice. I've read some headlines, you know, where people have said that PE firms are, you know, refusing to write down their portfolios. But, you know, I've not seen that. And you know, if we look at our portfolio, the governance around it, around valuations is still strong. I mean, you're talking about, you know, all of our private equity managers in APO revalue their portfolios on a bottom-up basis every quarter. All of their investments are in line with, are valued in line with international private equity and venture capital you know, valuation guidelines. They're all in line with either IFRS or US GAAP accounting standards. They're all audited at least annually. And then our auditors at the trust level then take a sample and audit the valuation methodology of the largest positions in the book. And then we as managers scrutinize the valuations. Our audit committee as well scrutinize the valuations on a quarterly basis. So the scrutiny of the valuations is multi-layered, and so the idea that, you know, all of these, you know, elements of governance are, you know, the people involved are the stakeholders are kind of asleep at the wheel would be is quite unrealistic. You know, private equity doesn't act like levered listed equity, and we can go into the reasons why. But coming back to your question on discounts, I think if you are long term minded, right now provides an excellent opportunity in my eyes, given how wide these discounts are relative to the longer trends. And, you know, especially when you consider just finally that, you know, private equity tends to make a lot of its best performing investments during periods of uncertainty, when pricing tends to be a bit more reasonable, when more interesting assets come to market. So maybe long held family owned businesses or corporate carve-outs or public to private. So it's, you know, more differentiated type deal flow comes to market at more reasonable pricing.
So looking again at valuation, Alan, you know, when you're looking out there at, you know, at the market at the moment, are you seeing better opportunities on a valuation basis than, you know, maybe this time last year? And, you know, within that, when you're valuing the portfolio, you did say there we can maybe expand on that, and I think that would be quite a good point to do, because you mentioned that there was an 11% increase on NAV, but at the same time we're seeing a big widening in the discount. You know, given what's happening out there, are you starting to see valuations soften, and is that giving you any opportunities, do you feel?
Well, look, I think if we look at our latest quarter, the values grew constant currency around 2.2%. So we're not seeing a softening on valuation, and we can go into the reasons why. In terms of more broadly on pricing of new assets in this market, I think it's quite difficult to say there's been a real step change because private equity M&A has fallen quite considerably. And so not many things have traded. And the things that have traded have tended to be A-plus assets that have a strong buy and build component to their value creation strategy. So the ability to sort of blend down the entry multiple with smaller bolt-on acquisitions that you can acquire at cheaper multiples. There just hasn't been that much activity, really. So it's difficult to say if pricing has really changed. I mean, the stuff that we have seen traded at less than, you know, pricing we saw in 2021 and early 22, but perhaps not as much as you would think. But on the valuations more broadly and of the sort of unrealized book, you know, I sort of alluded to the governance of it a little bit earlier, but there's a few other things I'd pull out. You know, firstly, it's worth noting that private equity funds typically charge management fees on commitments and the cost of investment, not on value. Plus, their carried interest, the equivalent of a performance fee, is paid upon cash received from the realization of investment. So that in reality, there's very little incentive for performing private equity managers to be aggressive when valuing their unrealized portfolio. In fact, it's quite the opposite. You know, the market has grown so accustomed to private equity managers selling companies at an uplift to book value that that's almost now expected in a market norm. And we can discuss that a bit later on as well. But relating to our portfolio and sort of you alluded to that 11% growth, the first thing I'd mention is that earnings growth has been really strong and continues to be. So if I take our top 50 underlying portfolio companies, we've got 656, I think, at last count in the portfolio. But our top 50 is 42% of the portfolio value. That cohort grew in terms of earnings by 24% on average during financial year 2022. So these businesses are still growing in a more difficult backdrop. Now, why was that, I guess, is the obvious response. It's sort of, there's obviously some hangover from the global pandemic in the comparative 21 numbers, but I believe the strong growth is principally because private equity buyout managers changed their focus following the global financial crisis, became more focused on market-leading non-discretionary businesses in resilient markets that crucially have pricing power. So we're talking about mission-critical businesses in technology, B2B services, healthcare, which have kind of replaced the typical investments prior to the global financial crisis, which were, you know, in consumer discretionary, traditional bricks and mortar retailers, casual dining roll-ups, or in industrials, the chemical businesses, manufacturers. So more resilient businesses. And to help illustrate that, you know, in terms of our portfolio, the healthcare sector has increased from 6% in 2012 to 21%, and the largest single sector in our trust at the end of financial year 22. So real increase in more resilient sectors, which I think are creating that stronger earnings growth during more uncertain periods. And I think private equity managers, we mentioned before, are better at creating value now than they were 10 years ago. But I guess, again, then the follow-on question would be, right, okay, in terms of valuations, if earnings have been growing, you know, surely the decline in public markets and higher interest rates, et cetera, discount rates, you know, means that the multiples applied to earnings in the valuation have declined. And they have. But it's important to understand how private equity has valued for a long time. And we're focused on the buyout market, so majority held businesses, cash generative businesses. But typically, to derive a multiple, a private equity firm uses a basket of listed comparables and transaction comparables, and both have their flaws. Listed comparables are marked to market at the date of valuation, which is clearly optimal, but it's typically larger businesses than the private business you're valuing, typically lower growth, subsector can often not be a perfect match. On the other hand, transaction comparables are often private transactions, similarly sized, similar growth trajectories, but the timing is over a longer time period. And so that creates a buffer in private equity valuations when you take a mix of those two, and especially when you consider private equity firms tend to apply an illiquidity discount to the basket of listed comps. So that leads to that point I mentioned earlier around diversification and why private equity and public equity aren't perfectly correlated. And to evidence that, private equity tends to value at an uplift, as I alluded to earlier. So in our portfolio, we've calculated it over the last 10 years, an average uplift of around 25% when private equity sells a business compared to the valuation, the unrealized valuation 2 quarters prior. Bain & Co. in their recent global private equity report calculated that over 70% of private equity exits between 2012 and 2022 were at an uplift to the valuation only a quarter prior. So I think that illustrates how private equity valuations have been relatively conservative, I would say, over the last 10 years. Now, it could be argued now, what does it mean now? Could this uplift upon exit evaporate now, given valuations and given public markets? And frankly, that's yet to be tested with any sort of scale, but we have seen initial positive signs with managers in APO's portfolio, like HG selling Transporeon, or Nordic Capital selling Binding Site, or CVC selling April. They sold those businesses in the second half of 22 at an uplift to their valuation. So the uplift seems to have persisted, and I think that underlines how private equity valuations, particularly in the buyout space, which we're focused on, have been conservative for some time.
So there's a few points in there, Alan, which I'd like to pick up on. But the first of all, the interesting point that I think would be worth expanding on is how the underlying portfolio holdings in healthcare has gone from, I think you said, for about 6% back in 2012 to around 20% very recently. Obviously, that's a big shift in the allocation to that. I mean, how's that playing out? And are there any other trends that you're looking at now that you may be making bigger allocations to in the future?
Yeah, so we're really pleased with our healthcare portfolio. And some of that is managers, obviously, investing more in healthcare, like I mentioned. But it is also us as manager here of the trust overall, backing more healthcare specialist private equity funds, but also co-investments as well. So we've got a good, strong number of healthcare assets in the portfolio. I mentioned NAMSA earlier, but we've got others like Prolenium and various others. So it's sort of deliberate at both the manager level or the private equity manager level, at the fund level, and then us at our level sort of pivoting that way. And what we've typically invested in subsector-wise is sort of healthcare services businesses, pharma businesses, and some med tech, but med tech's been quite highly priced over the last wee while. We're pleased with that. I wouldn't expect healthcare to grow much more than where it's at now, 20-21%. But it's similar with technology as well, to be honest. I mean, technology is just the second largest sector, sort of around 20%. It's just behind healthcare. But again, a deliberate shift there because of more focused on B2B embedded technology businesses that are, non-discretionary, less of the sort of consumer tech, high growth, high cash burn businesses. It's been more kind of the businesses, the ERP businesses that the small and medium enterprises can't live without. So that's grown as well. But to your question, as we look ahead, I mean, what else might grow in that portfolio? Well, I think at the moment we've only got 1% in energy, which I think historically we're very happy with because, our experience is that, sectors that are well tied to commodity pricing tend not to do that well through the cycle in a private equity model. That's been our experience. But as I look ahead, the green transition could be an enormous opportunity, and it'll be the private markets that really drive that. So we're starting to see a bit more opportunities in that space. And when we look at energy, it might be that that begins to increase with sort of green transition type of technologies. But aside from that, I would say or expect the sort of sector breakdown to be pretty consistent. We don't want a single sector to be more than 25% of the portfolio, and I expect that tech and healthcare will continue to lead the way given their more resilient properties.
Thank you. So it'd be good to move on now, Alan, to what you see for the rest of this year. And I think it would be good if you could bring back in an element about the discount, because that will be something that I know listeners to this podcast will be particularly interested to get your views on how you see that being alleviated for the rest of this year. And, generally in private equity, how do you see the rest of this year playing out?
We'll start with the general outlook. I obviously remain very positive and confident on the prospects for the asset class. But what I would say is 2023 is proving to be a tougher year so far, and I expect it to continue to be tough for the remainder of it. And then certainly in terms of M&A levels. So mainly new investments and exits have fallen quite considerably. There's a disconnect. I think there's still a disconnect between buyer and seller expectations that really emerged from the middle of last year, following the war in Ukraine and, you know, the sharp increase in inflation and interest rates. And then debt to finance new deals has become less available, more expensive, meaning the private equity firms have had to really think deeply how they finance these assets. There's still private credit funds that can provide financing, but if it's that much more expensive and these private credit funds have the pick of the market, it's always going to be a bit more tough. And hence we saw quite a considerable drop off in deal flow, down close to 60% in the first quarter of 2023 relative to Q1 22. So I think the first half of the year is going to see quite low levels of M&A relative to the sort of long-term mean. I think in this market, a lot of our private equity managers have been focusing on making small add-on acquisitions for their current portfolio companies. So driving the value inorganically that way. And I think as well, the sort of relative lack of exits that you will see, in the first half of 2023 will have an impact on NAV as well, NAV growth as well, because I mentioned earlier about the uplift upon exit when private equity sells a business. That obviously drives NAV growth. And so I expect that that will be lower in terms of contribution than in recent years. So you're relying on earnings growth in the underlying unrealized portfolio to drive NAV. So it might be NAV is a little bit more moderate in terms of growth this year. But all of that said, I think, private equity firms are sitting on record levels of capital. The market can only stay quiet so long. And as I mentioned earlier, the private equity makes its best investments during these times. So that's exciting. And I do feel cautiously optimistic that deal flow will come back in the second half of the year. I think the spread between buyers and sellers' expectation will close. And I hope that more certainty in the wider financial markets around inflation and interest rates in particular will drive that. And it will help banks come back cautiously to provide new LBO financing too. So I think that, the current challenges are temporary. But to your point around discount, I've almost stopped trying to guess what the discount's going to do, because I'd never get it right. I would like to think that the discounts will start to come in. I think that, and materially so as the year progresses. I think a lot of it, as we mentioned earlier, is around valuation skepticism. And as times pass and the values don't drop, 20% or whatever the market's expecting, people will realize there is an opportunity here with private equity if they're longer term minded. And we'll start to see those discounts come in to the more historic levels, sort of in the diversified ones around, 15, 16, 17%. And then some of the direct ones, in the single percentages. Frankly, I've scratched my head around the discount for so long and the fact that private equity is on a discount at all, given the uplifts upon exit. But obviously, I'm quite biased in terms of the subject.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really good point to highlight there, Alan. You know, in summary, you've described a portfolio with underlying earnings growth and NAV growth, but at the same time, a discount that's been widening on little basis from the underlying assets. It seems like it's a market sentiment thing as opposed to anything to do with the underlying company. So I think that's one thing to take away from this. And just to finish off now, Alan, people will be listening to this and, you know, getting a good idea of how the fund works. It will be good just to finish, if you may, with a couple of examples of companies that are held within the portfolio, just to give people a flavour of the type of companies they'll be getting access to.
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, we have, it's best to talk about the co-investments, to be honest, because they're generally the larger positions. So, I mean, we have access to our Action. The discount retailer is the largest position in our book at around 5% of NAV. That's obviously held through the 3i Trust as well. So that continues to grow strongly. And obviously, there's a lot of information out there about that. Likewise, Visma with HG, which many will be familiar with, the ERP business in the Nordics and in Benelux. It's one of those, as I mentioned earlier, deeply embedded software businesses. You know, one of the last things a company would, you know, stop paying for, along with their electricity. It's so embedded in their workflows. And that's what we like about it. It's very, very resilient. But then some of the ones that are not available elsewhere, I mean, I would pull out things like ACT, which is an environmental services business. It basically helps corporates make the transition to becoming greener and help them with their climate attestations, whether that's for regulatory reasons like a aviation business, or voluntary reasons like a company looking to demonstrate its carbon neutrality. ACT's a business that helps them do that, and that's growing very, very strongly because that market is growing exponentially. And then I'll maybe round off with European Camping Group, which is unsurprisingly a campsite operator in France, Spain, Italy and Croatia. That's performing very well. That was our bet on the recovery in travel and leisure post-COVID. It's doing what we thought it would and more in terms of organic growth. But it also recently acquired one of its main peers, a business called Vacances Select. So it's undergone a transformatory merger. So that's another one we're really excited about. And yeah, overall, you know, we're really, you know, really positive on in terms of the co-investment book and the 25 assets we have in there. We have none of them are significantly underperforming, but we've got a lot that are performing ahead of plan. So touch wood, that continues.
So just as one final point, and it is again on the co-investment side of things, because it seems like there's a lot of interest from you as a manager in these ones that you can co-invest in. Do you have more of an input into those businesses? And if so, is that one of the attractions of looking at co-investment businesses?
Well, I think we're still stock selectors in terms of co-investment. So we're rarely on the board, for example. We delegate that to the private equity managers, so, you know, that we partner with. And that's why it's very, very important that we, you know, develop the relationship with those managers and diligence them thoroughly, so we can have that confidence. But certainly we decline an awful lot of co-investment flow. So we have a lot of influence in terms of how we're constructing that portfolio. Certainly don't just accept any old co-investment that come our way. You know, for example, I think last year we received in Europe about 90 co-investment leads, and I think we did across all mandates around 15 or 20. So it's yeah, we are declining way more than we're doing, but you know, we are essentially passive investors. We've got to make sure we get the stock selection right, and you know, we're partnering with the right managers, and we think we're doing that.
That's great, Alan. Thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure.
And just as a final note to listeners, do check out the notes to this podcast, and you'll find a link through to the investment trust website, where you'll be able to find some more information, have a look at their fact sheets and recent performance. So, Alan, once more, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you. This podcast was presented by Oanda, TradingView's most popular broker. Trade with Oanda and get 1 year subscription to TradingView Pro. 76.6% of retail investor accounts lose money when trading CFDs with this provider. You should consider whether you understand how CFDs work and whether you can afford to take the high risk of losing your money.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember all investment involves risk.